Hi, my name is June. I'm an alcoholic. Oh, and thank you all so much for allowing me to be part of your conference. I'd like to ask a favor, if you don't mind. I'd just like to see the hands of anyone who's here in their first year of sobriety or at their first convention. Are there any people? All right, great. Welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I find that conventions have added tremendously to my life throughout the years that I've been sober. I was having a lot of sentimental memories as I sat in the meetings earlier today remembering, and I do remember my very first convention, and I remember many of them over the years. You know, sometimes it's kind of like I didn't just need a meeting, I needed a convention. And I'll tell you, in the short time that I've been here, I've already seen that you guys are going to have one hell of a weekend. I can see the amount of service, you know, that so many people have been involved in. And I really want to thank Richard and this committee, you know, for encouraging your delegate to be a part, you know, and to make a statement. General service has been incredibly important to me over the years. And one of my favorite members of Alcoholics Anonymous, who I've thought a lot about in the last couple days driving down here, is a guy named Cliff Roach. I know a number of you did know Cliff, and if you don't or haven't ever heard of him, I'd encourage you to check with the taper and see if you could get a copy of Cliff's talk. He was a wonderful member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and he was a good friend to me and a lot of other people. And, you know, one of the things that I was thinking about in these last few days as I was coming here, because I normally, whenever I've been at this conference, which has, you know, been a few times over the years, I would always get to see Cliff and Pat. And Mark and I did stop and see Pat yesterday, which was wonderful. But Cliff and I, we had a lot of laughs. And there's a line in our book that says, "We find that cheerfulness and laughter make for usefulness." And I know that Cliff added a lot of usefulness to my life and to a lot of other lives. And I'm hoping, if I can kind of stay on point as I go through my story a little bit, that I can tell you a little bit about some of the ways that that Cliff added to my life and continues to add to my life. I like to start out by saying the very most, I'm going to keep my timer up here so that I don't lose track. I like to start out when I'm asked to talk for this long saying the most important thing that I'm going to say, so that if you're anything like me, certainly when I was new, I could not listen to these people going on and on. I had a lot of real problems, and I needed to think about me and my problems. And sadly, even sometimes today, I don't always listen to everything that's happening in the meeting. I still get back to thinking about myself. So just in case you're anything like me, if you are relatively new, or if you happen to be visiting Alcoholics Anonymous with a family member or someone else, I'm going to tell you right now the most important thing I'm going to say the whole time I'm up here, and then you really don't have to pay that much attention to anything else. So the very most important thing that I could tell you is that I am not an expert on alcoholism, on Alcoholics Anonymous, on any step, on any page in the Big Book, on anything at all. I'm simply a member, and I'm going to stand up here and do the best I can at sharing my experience, strength, and hope. The other thing that's very important to me and that I like to always include when I say the most important things, you know, over the years, people come to Alcoholics Anonymous, as they always had, through a variety of different ways. A lot of us came through a family member. Some of us came through a judge. Some people came through a doctor or perhaps a minister or a rabbi. You know, there's just lots and lots of ways that people come to Alcoholics Anonymous. Over the years, I find that more and more people have come into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous through some type of perhaps a hospital or a detox facility or whatever it might be. And I really don't think it matters how anybody gets to Alcoholics Anonymous. But because people come in some different ways, sometimes they get a little bit confused about what part was the hospital and what part's Alcoholics Anonymous. So this is the most important thing I wanted to tell you about that whole preview I just gave you. Alcoholics Anonymous is absolutely free. If Alcoholics Anonymous had not been free, I could not have come. If Alcoholics Anonymous had not stayed free, I could not have stayed. I was sober over 10 years in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous before I could afford to put a dollar in the basket at the Seventh Tradition on anything like a regular basis, and I have not always been able to put a dollar in since I was 10 years sober. This is not about money. And that's really important to me that you know that. At the same time, thankfully, over the years, I have been able to become self-supporting through my own contributions, and I am able today to contribute to my home group and to other meetings that I attend, and most importantly for me, regularly to our general service office, so that Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, can stay alive and growing in a lot of other countries and in a lot of other places. So I, those are the things that I wanted to go ahead and say. You know, I think one of the things that I like so much about conventions is that I believe that one of the greatest gifts that we have in Alcoholics Anonymous is that we are people who normally would not mix. And the bigger the group, and we certainly have a very large group already, and I know it's going to grow over the weekend, you know, there's no way that you could look at this group and not see that we are people who normally would not mix. And I do believe it to be one of the strengths. I also feel very fortunate to have been born in a time when Alcoholics Anonymous exists. I never met my father, but from what I've been told about my father was born over in Ireland. Before he was born, his father, my grandfather, was killed as the drunk driver at 46 years old over in Ireland. He was killed along with other people in his car and along with people in another car. And when my grandfather died at 46 years old, Alcoholics Anonymous did not exist yet. There was no Alcoholics Anonymous. He left my grandmother with 13 children, one of whom was my father. When my father came over to Canada, actually, and my father was to drink himself to death alone in a hotel room. And when my father was born, Alcoholics Anonymous did not exist yet. When my mother was born, Alcoholics Anonymous was less than 1 year old. And my mother was to be an alcoholic who was going to go in and out of the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous for over 40 years with varying periods of sobriety. And so here I am, having been born an alcoholic at a time when we have a solution. When Alcoholics Anonymous exists, there are people in this room, I won't name them, I'll just look at them, but anyway, there are people in this room that I know were born before Alcoholics Anonymous existed. And because we have that solution, and because of one alcoholic talking to another, they're here, they're sober, and I feel very, very fortunate to be here and to be alive and to be sober. I grew up in this alcoholic family. My mom was a single parent. I'm an only child. I grew up with a lot of violence. I grew up with a lot of broken promises. I grew up with a lot of other kinds of abuse that were happening in my life and in my home. And by the time I was 5 years old, I needed a way out. And I looked for that way out in the ways that I could come up with. At 5 years old, I started taking overdoses of baby aspirin. It was all I could find at five. But I was always looking for a way out. And I loved finding out years later, after I got sober in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, that they were originally going to call the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous The Way Out. But I found out there were too many other books already named that, so they called it Alcoholics Anonymous. And if I go off on my different tangents, as I do often when I'm talking, because I'm kind of like one of those dogs in the Disney movie, it's like, squirrel, you know, and I totally don't get back to it. Let me just be sure to tell you that because of the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous, all of them, that I have applied as best I could at, you know, all these different levels at different times. But because of those, I've had a psychic transformation. And I didn't believe it would happen for me. I wasn't sure anything like that could ever happen for me. And because of that, I've been given that gift that it talks about in the foreword in the 12 and 12, where it says that, you know, we find that these principles can allow the sufferer, you know, not to crave alcohol any longer and to live happily and usefully whole. And I have found that here in Alcoholics Anonymous. Not every minute, not every second, nothing like that, nothing perfection about anything that I've done. But I have had that psychic transformation, and it's been a lot slower than I would have liked. And so I encourage you, if you're new, you know, to stay in Alcoholics Anonymous and to get really active. So as I mentioned, my mom was an alcoholic who was going to go out in and out, so I knew about Alcoholics Anonymous long before I ever came here. I didn't really think it worked because my mom kept drinking. My mom was going to be my greatest teacher in this idea that we talk about so often in meetings about the fact that this is a progressive disease. That if you're an alcoholic, like we talk about in the doctor's opinion and that we talk about in the book, and you keep drinking, it will get worse, never better. And I feel more grateful every year that my mom was able to show me that. Because by the time I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, quite honestly, if they had said to me, you know what, June, you keep running the streets, you keep drinking and doing the things that you're doing out there in Venice Beach, you know, we guarantee you, you keep it up, you're going to be dead in 6 months. We promise you. If the old timers here in Alcoholics Anonymous had promised me that, I would have run back out and kept drinking. They told me that I wasn't going to be lucky enough to die, that I was going to continue to live the way that I was living, that I was going to get, it was going to get worse, that I was going to hate myself more than I already did, and I just couldn't even imagine that that was possible. I started to drink on a regular basis when I was 8 years old. I had already been using other chemicals that I needed. I needed a way out. And I'm extremely grateful to alcohol and the other things that I mixed with it, because it helped me shut off the pain sometimes. You know, one of our old timers, Clancy, would talk about this idea of not having any emotional insulation whatsoever. And that was me. I had that crippling sensitivity that we talk about, you know, in our literature. And in growing up, I always had this hair. I went to 18 grammar schools, 7 junior highs, 5 high schools. I've only finished 7th grade. We moved a lot. I was always the new kid. I was always being teased. And these strangers would tease me, and I felt like I was being cut up inside with a knife. And I didn't even know their name. So that kind of sensitivity was one of the first things that I saw and began to hate in myself. And I never forgave myself for being weak and unable to control my emotions until long after I was sober in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. But to the extent that alcohol worked for me, which it did for until I got here, it let me not care. It let me not care about you. Certainly let me not care about me. And if you live not caring about you and not caring about me, then you're going to find yourself in situations where you're going to know about pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. And so, growing up, all I wanted to do was be tough. I mean, if I had to tell you what I wanted in one sentence when I came to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, probably the only thing that I could think of that I wanted in those years before coming to Alcoholics Anonymous and for a number of years after I got here, I wanted the ability to walk into a room full of strangers and have everyone there back away from me in terror. But when you're 87 pounds, as I was, that almost never happens. And I was a person who found I would much rather you punch me in my face than hurt my feelings. And you have to take my word for it, I was very good at getting people to punch me in my face. And so I had a lot of black eyes, I had a lot of swollen lips, I got beat up a lot. I've done a lot of fighting, I was in a gang, I've done a lot of fighting. I've never won a fight in my life. I like to make sure you know that. But I've never fought less than 5 people at a time. And my sponsor explained to me after I'd gotten sober that, you know, if you fight 5 people, no one's expecting you to win. You know, and so it was one of those little sacrifices I was willing to make, you know what I mean? That somebody might think I was tough because that many people had to jump me. Anyway, I was brought to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous another time when my mother was coming back another time. And I didn't want to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't want to go to a meeting. I certainly didn't want to belong to an organization that was allowing my mother to belong to it. I blamed my mother for everything that had ever gone wrong in my life, and a lot had gone wrong. But she brought me to that meeting that night, and there was a guy in that meeting that I admired, And I did not admire very many people. And I'm sure a lot of you are not going to identify or understand things that I admired about this guy, but I'm here to share my story. This guy was a guy who drank with my mother. He drank in those really violent bars where there was frequently a pool cue through somebody's head, or somebody was shot, or somebody was stabbed, or someone was arrested, or something horrible happened. And he was the kind of guy that if he walked into the bar and he wanted to sit at a table, you would move and give him the table. And I saw him at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I thought, if you could achieve all of that, why would he come to AA? He had already made it, you know. And he was at that meeting, and I spent some time in between the next couple of 2 weeks going to meetings. I didn't raise my hand. I didn't want to be an alcoholic. I wasn't an alcoholic. But I spent all this time explaining to Paul why I wasn't an alcoholic, why I wasn't anything like my mother, who was an alcoholic, why I was too young to be an alcoholic, why I had places to go, people to see, things to do. I had my whole life ahead of me. I couldn't possibly be an alcoholic. And then I later found out, as we all do, that, you know, no one who's not an alcoholic spends time trying to convince other people they're not alcoholic. Only alcoholics do that, you know. And so he turned to me and he said, June, I'm new in AA, and they tell me I can't diagnose anybody's disease but my own. He said, but in your case, I'm going to make an exception. He said, I've seen the way that you drink, I've seen the way that you use other chemicals, and I happen to believe if you don't come into this program, take what these people to offer you within a period of 6 months or less, you're going to be out on the streets, you're going to be shooting stuff, and you're going to be selling your ass. And I knew he wasn't trying to scare me. I knew he wasn't trying to make up something. I knew he was talking about things that had happened or were beginning to happen in my life, and I thought about what he said, and I did not want to believe that I had to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. And yet in that 2 week period of time, every option but Alcoholics Anonymous was removed. My mother and I had a violent relationship. We had had that for a while. We were both drinking. We were both angry, hostile, and violent. My mom was getting sober and she told me I couldn't be in her apartment because I was too violent. I left. The rest of my family didn't really know where I was. They lived out of state and they didn't really know where I was, and they weren't really trying to find me. I actually didn't get invited to any family activities until I was over 5 years sober in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was in a lot of foster homes. None of them wanted to take me back. And then I thought one day, you know, I thought, well, you know, who cares? Who cares about family? Who cares about, you know, foster homes, you know, whatever. I tried to get in a couple drug recovery homes. There were only three, I think, at the time, an alcohol home or something like that, and none of them would take me, some because of my age and some just because of my attitude. And then I thought, well, you know what, all that really matters if you're a tough broad like I was hoping to be is my gang. And then one day as I walked down an alley, all five members of my own gang beat me up. And so I found myself sitting in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was 87 pounds, I had a black eye, I had a swollen lip, I didn't have any shoes because I'm from Venice Beach and we have to have tough feet, and I wouldn't have worn them if I did have them. And I sat in that meeting, I raised my hand. I had no place else to go. I had no one to make no one who would have taken a collect phone call. I didn't have a place to live. And so I raised my hand in that meeting. I know today that there were a few people in that meeting that did not know about the traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous. I certainly didn't know about the traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous. My mother had been in and out of that group for probably 10 years already at that time, and so some of those people knew who I was, and some of those people knew how old I was, and because they didn't know about the traditions, they came over to me after the meeting and they said, we don't want a little kid in our meetings while we talk about serious things, and if you come back, we're going to get together and throw you out. And I just thought AA didn't want me either, and I didn't want me either. I had not wanted me for as long as I could remember, and so I fell back on my number one answer. The answer I used as long as I could, I went over to a friend of my mother's house. I went into her bathroom, which is the first place I went at any home I ever visited. I found enough of the kind of pills that I needed to take to kill myself, and I took enough of them to do it. And when I got to the noon meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous that I went to after that, they realized I needed to be in a hospital. And a doctor gave me something that made me throw up and explained that had I been there 5 or 10 minutes later, I would have been in a coma that they probably couldn't have brought me out of. And I don't know why that was so different than all those other times that I tried to take my life and I tried to get out. But I know that it was, because since that time, one day at a time, I haven't taken anything that affects me from the neck up, and that's how I personally define sobriety. And I've done that one day at a time. It's the only thing I've done perfectly in all the years that I have been sober here in Alcoholics Anonymous. But You know, it's really important. You know, years ago I was, I'd been sober maybe 20 some years or something. I was listening to a tape, and I still listen to lots of CDs and tapes and stuff, and I really enjoy hearing other, you know, speakers. And this one speaker, I think he had like 29 years. He had longer than I was sober. And he said, you know, if I had to share the single most important thing that I have done every day, the thing that is really important, the one thing I never miss, you know, I've never missed doing, the one thing that's so important for me to have 29 years. And I thought, oh my gosh, you know, what if I'm not doing this thing? I better listen, you know, so I could add this to my program. He said, I'd have to say the single most important thing is not drinking. And, you know, I really want to encourage you to believe that. Because if we don't drink, no matter what, and we reach out to someone else for help, I've always been able to find someone in Alcoholics Anonymous that has been willing to share some kind of an experience, you know, with me. And so I am a person who believes that we don't drink no matter what. And that has served me very, very well. You know, I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, and as I said, I had no family, I had no money, I had no education really beyond seventh grade, I didn't have a job. I didn't have a regular place to live for a number of years after I got sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. I want to let you know that there was much kindness in Alcoholics Anonymous when I came here, as I hope that you will find, you know, now if you're new. But I wasn't really capable of accepting kindness. And so I'm very grateful to the old-timers who were here who tolerated me exactly how I was and told me to keep coming back anyway. I had a very bad attitude. I'd always had a bad attitude. I didn't like me. I didn't like anything about me. In fact, I actually hated myself so much that I was almost nauseous with the hatred that I felt about myself. I didn't want anybody to get near me, and I found a number of different ways, you know, that I could keep people away. When I got sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, I had a jacket, and on the back it said, "Do unto others and then split." It was my own spiritual philosophy. Back then I smoked 3 packs of cigarettes a day. I'm not sure I necessarily smoked each one of those cigarettes because I was always lighting the next one with the next one, but it was sort of like I had something lit that people wouldn't want to get too close to something fiery and hot. After I'd been sober for a little while, I took up smoking cigars and then a pipe. That seemed to back a few people away. I had a pretty limited vocabulary. It included, you know, a few other words like the and mother, but mostly it was profanity. I wore a chain on my wrist and one on my ankle. I'd just been beaten up by my own gang, so I was 87 pounds. I had a black eye, I had a swollen lip, and, you know, they made me the greeter. And I would stand at the door welcoming the new people as they came to AA, and sometimes you'd hear their sponsor or whoever brought them to the meeting kind of whisper, you know, if you keep drinking, you can end up like that, you know. And at the time that I stood at that door, there were people sometimes who would try and guess how old I was, and they were guessing my age at 37. If you'd looked at my birth certificate, it would have told you that I was 13. And if you'd asked me, I would have told you I'm 1,000 years old. And there is nothing in these meetings, these steps, this literature that's ever going to change that. Because once you're 1,000, you just can't change that. It's just can't be fixed. And yet I stayed in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I didn't drink no matter what, and I didn't believe that Alcoholics Anonymous could work for someone as broken and damaged as I was. And you know, I also of course can look back over the years and see that there were a lot of things that I did in those early years to sabotage, you know, any progress that I might have been, you know, making. The thing that I did was I stayed close to Alcoholics Anonymous. I stayed active in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I went to 21 meetings a week my first 2.5 years, not because I wanted to get a gold star in AA, not to make my sponsor love me or be happy. By the way, I'm extremely grateful they didn't have caller ID when I got sober, because really I'm not sure my sponsor would have answered as many of my calls as she did, but she did answer them. But it was because I had no place else to go. I had no place else to go that was indoors for years. And so I went to a lot of the meetings early. I left a lot of the meetings late, and then I'd go out to coffee with whatever group was going, And sometimes we'd be out to coffee till maybe 11, 12, 1, depending on what night of the week it was. And then I would walk outside of the coffee shop and I would hitchhike back to the beach so that I could walk around. And, I have a sponsor today. My sponsor is Bob Regan. He's got 57 continuous years of sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous. And sometimes when I would go outside and stand there hitchhiking, Bob would come out of that restaurant and he'd call his wife and his two, and let her know that he wasn't going to come home right away to his two kids, that he was going to drive me 20 miles out of his way back to Venice and then drive 20 miles back to be with his family. Because Bob was worried about a 13 or a 14-year-old girl getting into a car with strangers. I wasn't worried about that. I just thought, yeah, maybe something bad will happen. Maybe they'll kill me. It's always going to be like that anyway, so what's the difference? And I didn't care enough about myself to protect myself, you know, but there were members of Alcoholics Anonymous that did. And Bob wasn't my sponsor back then. He was an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous, though, back then, and continues to be. So, it's not really that funny. Just a few years ago, I was sitting in a meeting, and Bob was here, and I was talking about it, and I said, you know, I don't think I ever thanked Bob for doing that. I thought, well, you know, if I'm hitchhiking, if you're going to pick me up, then just pick me up. But I mean, I don't think I should thank you for it, you know. And so I did. I went over and I go, hey, thanks, Bob. You know, so I'm only about, you know, 50-some years later thanking him for the ride. My sobriety date is the 13th of July, 1972. So I have been continually sober for 51 and a half years. I've stayed active. I've stayed active in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous throughout that time. But, you know, when I mentioned before, you know, that I really struggled emotionally and financially tremendously, you know, in those first at least 10 years, you know, in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I felt like the biggest loser that was ever here. It seemed to me like everybody else got a 90-day chip and they suddenly became CEO of a company. You know, their family was giving them awards. You know, mine wasn't even sending me a Christmas card yet. You know, and I really, you know, I just thought, what am I doing wrong? What step did I miss? And I felt so sorry for myself. Oh my gosh, you know, I was very good at inflicting self-pity on anywhere I went. You know, there's a movie called Freaky Friday. I'm sure some of you have seen it, but the basic idea is this mother and teenage daughter, they end up, something magic happens and they switch places. But before that happens, you know, the teenage daughter is just, you know, kind of yelling at her mom, and she goes, "You are a fun sucker, Mom. You suck all the fun out of everything." And I came to Alcoholics Anonymous as a huge fun sucker. And, you know, I could come to your birthday party and I could ruin it. I could sit in a corner sobbing, you know, just telling one sad story after another. And I really did not believe that anybody in the world had ever suffered as much as I had. And, you know, years ago I was at the Brentwood meeting and there was a guy talking, and I don't know, I think I'm like 25 or 30 years sober at this point. I mean, I'm slow with some of this stuff. But anyway, he goes, an egomaniac is not someone who thinks well of themselves. And I thought, well, that's weird, because if you asked me, you know, like, what's an egomaniac? I'd think, well, it's someone who thinks I'm so smart and I'm so beautiful and I'm the best, you know. And he goes, an egomaniac is not necessarily someone who thinks well of themselves. Uh-huh. He said, it's not necessarily even someone who thinks often of themselves. It's simply someone who thinks only of themselves. And I realized, oh my gosh, you know, I was a huge egomaniac. But all my egomania was about, I'm so ugly, I'm so stupid, I'm the worst, I'm never going to be this, I'm, you know, whatever. But it was all self-obsession. And so I got very active, as I said, you know, in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I've stayed active. I got active in all these different types of service. And I have to tell you that I cannot even put into words how important service has been, you know, in my life in Alcoholics Anonymous. But it's been a very slow, an incredibly slow process. So I wanted to tell you a couple of different little stories, and then we'll see where I go. You know, I went to, I like to tell this story about the Palm Springs Roundup. So there was this Roundup that was a big deal in California back in the 70s when I got sober. And this was a convention, and I think there were 3,000 people that would go to this convention. And the only way that I ever got to go to that convention, well, any convention in those first 10 years or more, was if someone else bought a scholarship and they donated a badge to me. Or something like that, because I never could have afforded a registration. And my sponsor was very active in the Palm Springs Roundup, and so she would drag me around, and someone would let me sleep on their floor in their hotel room, because of course I didn't have that, and I didn't have a car, and I didn't have any money, and I didn't have a credit card, and all the clothes that I wore for the first 10 years I was sober were given to me by members of Alcoholics Anonymous, or bought for me at the Goodwill by members of Alcoholics Anonymous. And anyway, and so I was at this banquet one night. And now, back in the day, you know, it was Palm Springs in June, 100 degrees outside at least. But I want you to know, these women in particular, they were wearing their sobriety. I mean, they wore furs. It's 100 degrees, but they're like throwing their fur, you know, on the table there, and jewels, and, you know, this whole thing. They were all dressed up. And someone had given me a dress to wear. They'd loaned me a dress to wear. And so I was sitting there, and I was wearing a brown dress. And as I sat there, I was looking around the room, comparing myself to others, which I still do on times when I want to make myself feel bad. And I talked to myself. I still talk to myself, but I did talk to myself then. And so I was looking around, and I saw this woman wearing a very beautiful black dress. And I go, wow, doesn't she look elegant? Yes, she does. I answer my own questions. And I said to myself, I said, well, don't you wish you were wearing that beautiful black dress? I thought, no, I like this brown dress. I go, what do you mean you like this brown dress? I go, all right, wait a minute. Green is your favorite color. Do you see the woman over there in the incredibly gorgeous green dress? I go, yeah. Isn't that a gorgeous dress? Yes, it is. So I said to myself, and I said, don't you wish you were wearing that dress? And I said, no, I'm okay, I'm glad I'm wearing this brown dress. I thought, you gotta be kidding. Then I started asking myself other questions. Like, I didn't wish I was sitting at the fun table. You know the fun table. Why do I have to be over here? They're at the fun table. I'm never at the fun table. No, I was like, I was happy I was at that table. And then I didn't wish I had your mom. I didn't wish I hadn't dropped out of school in seventh grade. I didn't wish anything about my life on the outside was different. And I'm telling you, I can't even describe to you what a moment this was. There just aren't words, really, that I could explain. But beyond that, one more level deeper than I ever, ever, ever thought I would go, I realized I didn't want to feel different than I was feeling. I never had that. I didn't have that before I was drinking. I didn't have it while I was drinking if I didn't have enough alcohol in me, and I hadn't really experienced it that I remember in those early years of sobriety. And yet that night, right then, I wanted to feel just like I was feeling. I didn't wish I was sitting next to anybody else. I didn't want to be wearing anybody else's dress. I didn't want anything to be different. And I absolutely could not believe that Alcoholics Anonymous could have made that possible for someone like me, because I'm telling you, when I got here in July of 1972, I wanted to trade places with anybody. Anybody in the whole world I knew had it better than me. And I know it would make a much better AA talk if I could tell you that from that time at 7 years sober, for the next 43 years, I've never wished my hair looked different, I never wished I looked different, never wished I was at the fun table ever again. I can't tell you that, because that wouldn't be true. But I will tell you this, it's been many, many, many years since I have seriously been willing to even consider trading places with anybody. And that is unbelievable to me. I have been so overpaid in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous that there aren't enough minutes. There are so many miracles. I continue to be amazed. You know, our literature says you'll be amazed before you're halfway through. I mean, I'm quite sure I must be more than halfway through here, but I've been amazed for a really long time, and I continue. I just can't believe it. You know, I'm gonna go ahead and tell you. So after I have time to do this. Yeah. Oh yeah, I do. Okay. So I got here with the seventh grade education when I got active in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. My first sponsor, Gail Wilson, wanted me to go to high school, and I was put in a foster home that ended up not working out. I did try briefly. I don't know how hard I tried, but when I tell you that I felt 1,000 years old in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, I think perhaps that will help you understand when I tell you that I felt 2,000 years old on a high school campus. I could not be with these people. I could not. I was so broken and just so dirty and so awful. I just couldn't do it. And my sponsor said, all right, if you're not willing to get an education, then you'll get the kind of jobs that people who have seventh grade educations get. And those were the kind of jobs that I got. And I got a lot of different ones because I wasn't a very good employee, but it allowed me to get to a lot of meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I got these different jobs. And after I'd been sober a couple years, I wanted to get a driver's license, which you can't get in the state of California unless you get a driver's ed. And so I found out if I went to the city college that I could take a driver's ed class, and while I was there, I signed up for this thing. They called it a dummy English class. And I could have, if you'd asked me at 3 years sober to read chapter 5 or anything else in a meeting, I could read every word, and you wouldn't think there was anything wrong. But I'm telling you that when I was home alone and I tried to read the big book or I tried to read anything, I could not read a whole sentence and remember what I had just read. And I thought, I have done permanent damage here, and I didn't want to really let too many people know. So I thought maybe if I signed up for that dummy English class, maybe I could get my brain to remember things a little bit. And so that's what I did, and I did that, and I got some jobs, you know, cleaning apartments on the weekends, and I got some other little jobs, and I got a job in a restaurant, and I got a chance to go to school, you know, take more classes, and then I could get a job on campus at the cafeteria, so I get a discount on food, and I could get a job in the library, so sometimes I could study, and I was doing all these, you know, I'd had four or five different little part-time jobs, and I was taking more and more classes, and all of a sudden, at the end of 3 years, they call me in the office, the counselor's office, and they said, you know, you've completed all the requirements for what they called an AA college degree, which I thought was a nice name for a college degree. I never thought I was going to get one. And then they suggested that I take this thing called a GED, so I'd have an equivalent to the high school diploma. So I went ahead and I signed up for that, and I took that, and then I'd come up with this dream. And, you know, when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I didn't have any dreams, but somehow here at, you know, I guess by this time, I think I was about, I don't know, 5 years sober maybe, and I'd come up with a dream, and I told my sponsor my dream, and she said, well, you have to do the same footwork anybody in or out of AA has to do if they want to make a dream come true. So I started to do this footwork, and I applied to some universities, and I got accepted, and I went to a couple more years of school, and then I still had to do more footwork for my dream, and I went ahead and I did some more footwork, and it's been over 40 years ago now. I got a telegram telling me that I had been accepted as one of 300 out of 3,000 applicants to go to law school. I had always planned on spending a lot of time in court, but never on that side of the table. And I was able to go to law school, and I was able to complete law school, and I went on, and I was able to get a job, and it was a job that I believe I was able to be of service. I just resigned from my job during COVID, and I was at that job for 37 and a half years. I had a job where not one day did I ever go to work, ever, where I was not reminded of where alcoholism takes people like me. And alcoholism does not take everybody to the same places, but I know the places it takes people like me. And the only reason I was on one side of the bars and my clients were on the other side of the bars was because of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, most of the young women that I grew up with, I don't know any of them that aren't dead. You know, that didn't end up going to prison, weren't working the streets, having babies that were born addicted to things. You know, I mean, I know where I came from. And I'm not any smarter than those women. I'm certainly not any prettier than any of those women that were on the streets with me when I was growing up. You know, the only thing that I know that's different between them and me is something called Alcoholics Anonymous. Anyway, I had that job that I really, really loved. You know, it was, I think I was at the job maybe 10 years. I can't remember maybe a little bit longer, and they called me in, and one of the supervisors called me in, and they said, you know, we want you to be one of our trainers. We want you to help train the new lawyers because we like your attitude. And I thought, you know, in 1972, nobody in AA ever thought I'd get a job for my attitude. And I was thinking about when I was looking at the t-shirts, you know, that attitude of gratitude, because I did not have that for a long, long time. I sure have it today, though. You know, someone I was listening to on a meeting yesterday, I think it was just yesterday, and this woman was saying something that I'd heard over, you know, the years on Zoom. I don't really remember hearing it so much before, but maybe we said something and I just can't, you know, didn't really click with me. But they said, you know, don't let the life that AA gives you take you away from AA. And I've been very, very fortunate, you know, that I always stayed active in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, that I always kept my commitments. I didn't do it with a good attitude. I didn't do it because I believed it would work. I didn't do it for a lot of the right reasons. There's a lot of things that I've done in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, with a bad attitude or even bad motives, I think, sometimes, you know, ego or whatever it might be. But if I don't drink and I continue to show up and I continue to allow someone else to add to my life, you know, it works. I think that sometimes we talk about in Alcoholics Anonymous, oh, that was really inspiring, or, you know, he was inspiring or she was inspiring. And so I looked up, like, what does that mean? You know, I looked up inspire. And it means to touch someone's inner spirit, to touch someone's spirit inside. And that has continued to happen for me in Alcoholics Anonymous for 51 years. Don't get me wrong, I'm not a person who can say I've never been to a bad meeting. That wouldn't be accurate. I am not a person, you know, I heard a guy in Texas one time and he said, you know, if you like everyone in AA, you might not be going to enough meetings. So, I mean, I'm not, you know, it's not perfect, you know. Anyway, after, when I was in law school, I got married and I got married and I had, and I have, three daughters, which I still thought was so funny because I, you know, I tried to be a guy as long as I possibly could, even after I got sober. I just didn't want anything to do with being, you know, a woman or female. I didn't even sit in a row or anywhere wore pink until I was 10 years sober in case they thought I was getting kind of soft or, you know, feminine or something. And but anyway, and it was really a very difficult marriage. It was not easy at all. It wasn't really the right thing, but he tried, I tried. It was just it was a very long marriage, and it was really pretty unpleasant in a lot of ways. But about 20 years ago, I guess 20 years ago, we separated and got a divorce. And at that point, I'm 47 years old. And this is when Bob Regan became my sponsor. You know, I'd known him all those years, so he came into my life. He's my sponsor, and here I am. And I said, you know, I never thought of drinking. I never thought of killing myself. But I was sad, and I felt kind of like a loser getting a divorce. I thought everybody else in AA stays married, which is kind of silly because I sponsor a lot of people. I know that's not true, but I felt like I'd done something wrong somehow, even though I knew in my heart, in a way that I've rarely known anything, that this was the best thing anybody ever did was for us to not be together. And it was the best thing for him, it was the best thing for me, it was the best thing for the kids, but it was still a hard situation. And so, you know, I can remember I was talking to my sponsor and I said, you know, Bob, I'm just sad, you know, but, you know, it's gonna be, you know, here's what I believe. I believe that I have already had more miracles than anybody should ever have. I've already had more gifts than anybody should ever get in anywhere, you know. And so I think the best is already behind me, Bob. I think I'll just get a walker, put some stickers on it, you know, from the conventions, every convention I'll get a sticker. And, you know, and that's just kind of what's ahead. And Bob said, oh, you're not even going to believe how great your life is going to be 5 years from now. And I said, oh, Bob, I know we tell the new people those things. I said, but I've been sober, you know, 35, 36 years, Bob. The best is behind me. And he goes, no, it's not. And I said, well, I don't believe it. He goes, you don't have to. I'll believe it for you. And, of course, he was right. But, you know, right around that time, you know, the idea of dating was absolutely, I didn't like dating before I got married, you know, I mean, just no. no dating. I like sports, and so I took up surfing. And the reason that, you know, there was a lot of reasons why surfing was important, because for me, my higher power really is the ocean. It's certainly a power greater than myself. I heard Del talking about that, and it always has been. It's been very important to me and still is. But it also goes back to Cliff Roach, because when I was about 3 or 4 years sober, I came out here. I came to this conference sometimes, and you know, we had and Cliff took me surfing, and I had some fun with surfing. But Cliff took me surfing at like 5:30 in the morning, and I didn't have a wetsuit, so it was sort of like, you know, that's a once-in-a-lifetime kind of thing, and then you wait till you're in warm water. And so, you know, through my life, the next 30 years, I surfed if I was in warm water a little bit, played around with it, you know. But 30 years later, when I was hurting and I was having a hard time and I needed a sport, because that's something that helps me, I took up surfing. And it was really important to me, and it was a very spiritual thing for me. It means a lot. So I was out there, and I was, and by the way, I use the term surfing loosely here. I mean, I'm talking falling mostly, you know, not like carving up a lot of waves or whatever, but I did surf and stand up and do some stuff, you know. But anyway, so I was out there, you know, like day in and day out, and then I had this old timer in the program, and he asked me if I'd take a friend to his surfing, a guy he sponsored, and I said, oh, sure, but, you know, the guy had surfed longer than I had. And so I ended up taking Mark out there surfing, and, you know, he came into town, and we went and we surfed, and we developed this friendship. I thought we were going to be sports buddies, and then it became a romantic relationship, and we've been together over 15 years, and, you know, Mark and I both came from really, really violent alcoholic homes, with a lot of physical and verbal abuse. And because of what our sponsors have taught us through the years, because of the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous, that's not the way that we live, you know. I think so often, you know, that I could have missed it, you know. And I'm so grateful. You know, one of our old timers that I used to, well, every time I'd hear Norm Alpe talk, I always thought, I want to join AA. And then I'd remember I belonged, or I wouldn't have been there hearing Norm Alpe. But one of the things that Norm would say was, he would say, you know, but for a moment of grace, rooms like this, people like you, I could have missed it all. Thank you for not letting me.